KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
On Wednesday. City noise can be stressful. In fact, a new study by researchers at Boise State University say it can be so stressful on birds of prey that a bird would abandon its nest with the eggs still in them. Reporter Jessica Robinson has the story.
Busy roads have a certain appeal for birds of prey like the kestrel. The combination of power poles and open space makes highways prime real estate for catching rodents. But the researchers say these areas turn out to be an ecological trap. When it comes time to nest, blood tests show American kestrels that choose high traffic areas develop heightened levels of a stress hormone, and that makes them leave their nests.
You would find 5 cold eggs and no adults would come back to that nest.
Biologist Julie Heath co-authored the new study, which was published in the Journal of Applied Ecology. She says the kestrel builds its nest inside a cavity and relies on its hearing.
We think that in high noise areas, it's masking the cues that they would normally use to evaluate what's going on outside.
Female birds nesting near busy places like I-84 in southern Idaho were found to be 10 times more likely to abandon their nest. Heath says the study indicates that a bird's presence in an area doesn't necessarily mean that area is good habitat. I'm Jessica Robinson reporting.
53 degrees in Seattle. It's still cloudy, but it's getting less cloudy, and soon we'll call it partly sunny. Today's predicted high is 65. Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at ZurichNA.com. It's 10:06. I'm Bernard Ouellette. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. As Memorial Day approaches, we think about our military veterans, both the legacy they leave behind and the services they require. A new documentary film focuses on women in the military. We'll meet the filmmaker and one of the female vets in about 15 minutes. Also this hour, our gardening panel will be here to take your calls. But first, Seattle Public Schools Superintendent Jose Banda has revised the district's policy on an assessment test called the Measures of Academic Progress, MAP test. You may recall teachers in some Seattle schools refused to administer the test, a boycott that started at Garfield High School. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld has been following this story for months, and she joins us with an update. Hello.
Hello.
Well, before we talk about Superintendent Banda, can you explain what these MAP tests actually are?
Sure. The MAP test is a computerized test that kids in Seattle take in reading and math 2 or 3 times a year, starting in kindergarten through 9th grade, although kids in special ed and English language learners take it all the way through high school. The state doesn't require the MAP test, but Seattle School District does. It's also in use in a lot of other districts around the state.
So what does the school district do with the results of this test?
Well, the main stated purpose of the MAP test in Seattle is to gauge student learning throughout the year because it's given 2 or 3 times. But it's also used in conjunction with other measures in the district to place kids in middle school math classes and gifted programs. And for the past few years, the MAP test has also been a minor part of the teacher evaluation process.
So I know that the Garfield teachers initially decided they didn't want to administer this test. When was that initial protest and why?
It started in January of this year. The teaching staff at Garfield voted to boycott the test school-wide. They said that the test didn't actually meet its goal of helping teachers gauge student learning because teachers weren't allowed to see the test before or after it was given, so they didn't even know what was on it. And teachers said they had no way of interpreting students' scores. They also didn't like that the test took up so much classroom time and tied up the computer lab at Garfield several times a year for weeks. They said they had evidence that the test wasn't aligned with state or district standards at the 9th grade level had a margin of error that made the results statistically insignificant.
So this was a school-wide vote in Garfield High School, and I know a couple things happened. One is that the superintendent threatened to discipline them. The other was it was not a protest confined to Garfield. So can you
which came first? Was it the discipline, or was it the other schools joining in?
Right. A few other teachers at several other schools joined the protest in smaller numbers, or they signed letters of support for the protest. And big names in education across the country signed on in support, too. Noam Chomsky, Jonathan Kozol, Diane Ravitch, familiar names in education policy. And the boycott really garnered international support because of this larger movement about what people consider excessive use of standardized tests in the classroom and excessive focus on the importance of those test outcomes. Superintendent Jose Bonda responded by calling for a task force to examine the usefulness of the MAP test and other tests in the district. That was already underway before the protest began, but they kind of, you know, gave that a little bit of a push. But he insisted the teachers give the test in the meantime and follow district protocol. And he warned teachers they faced a possible 2-week suspension without pay if they refused to give the test.
But they refused to give the test.
They did not budge. And the superintendent eventually concluded that none of them had actually broken any rules because they weren't technically the ones responsible for administering the test. So none of the boycotting teachers ended up punished. And last week, the task force on the district's testing system came out with its recommendations, and the superintendent announced yesterday that he would follow their advice.
And what was that advice?
Well, the biggest change that they advised was for high school students who are at or above grade level in reading and math to no longer be required to take the test. High schools will still have to test kids who are below grade level in those subjects who are known to be below grade level. So that includes the ELL and the special ed kids. But they will vote as a school to use a different assessment if they want.
And this can be any assessment that they choose?
Well, the district seems to be pretty open-minded about what schools can use and is trusting them with that decision. And that was one of the main demands of teachers to begin with, was let us decide the best assessment for these kids. We want to know how they're doing, but let us be the ones to decide. They didn't want that mandate from on high.
So it wasn't the idea of testing per se that sparked the boycott at Garfield, but that particular test?
Teachers insisted that this was not an issue of testing. They say, we assess our kids on a minute-by-minute basis. We're constantly giving them little tests, whether it's calling on a kid randomly in class or administering a multiple-choice test. But they said, we want to be trusted with the decisions there, and we know what's best for our kids.
And I know you spoke with at least one teacher from Garfield High School yesterday for your story, and I wonder if they see this as a victory.
Yeah, they see it as at least partial victory. I spoke with Jesse Hagopian, who is a history teacher at Garfield High School and a leader of the boycott. He said that Garfield teachers feel vindicated and overwhelmed with joy at the decision. But the test will still be required in elementary schools because the district task force found that the test is still useful and valid at the elementary and middle school levels, and cited a survey that showed support for keeping the test among school staff at those grade levels. And Jesse Hagopian said that he still questions the usefulness of the test at those levels and says that the fight is not over in the district so long as the MAP test is in use.
Hmm. And in terms of parents, I know that a lot of parents joined that boycott as well, which was something that the teachers had called for. The fight is not over. What about the whole bigger idea of standardized testing in general?
Right. Teachers, or rather parents, families can opt their kids out of this test and many other tests. And many did at Garfield. You had just a handful of students ending up taking the test this quarter. You had lots of kids still in class. And the students really supported the teachers, and the student body signed on to the boycott. So you had really a large scale grassroots effort. And I'm sure that had something to do with the decision.
Ann Dornfeld is KUOW's education reporter. She's been covering what has been going on with the MAP test. And as she's reported, Superintendent Jose Bonda of the Seattle Public Schools yesterday announced that this test would not be mandatory in high schools except for certain kids not meeting standard levels. Thank you so much for your reporting and for coming in today.
My pleasure.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
A look at the special challenges that face disabled female U.S. veterans in a minute.
It's estimated only 2 in 5 Americans have a will, and less than 5% of all wills contain a charitable provision. Planning your legacy gift to KUOW can ensure public radio remains available for generations to come. For more information on how you can make a planned gift, go to kuow.org/future.
-53 degrees in Seattle. The sky is clearing. Forecast says it's going to wind up partly sunny today with an afternoon high of 65. Then clouds overnight dropping to 48. Tomorrow, Wednesday, expect showers with a high of 61. It's 10:15. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A bit later this hour, how to choose the right plants for your plot. When to sow, how to grow, how to tend, what to worry about, and what to leave be. Advice from a panel of expert organic gardeners in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. More women are serving in the American military than ever before. 14% of our troops are female, and that number is expected to double over the next decade. But the VA hospitals and the military itself are still male-oriented. So what happens when women who are veterans need help with everything from disability services to counseling for sexual assault? It's one of the questions that a new documentary film sets out to answer. Service, When Women Come Marching Home, looks at some of the challenges that face our female combat veterans. Filmmaker Marsha Rock joins us along with Angela Arellano, who's a veteran of the U.S. Marines now living in the Seattle area. She served more than 4 years in the military. She appears in this film. Also in the studio, Bridget Cantrell, a Bellingham-based psychologist who specializes in treating people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Welcome to all three of you. And Marsha Rock, I wanted to start with you. I understand that this was not the original documentary film you set out to make.
No, my co-producer, Patty Stotter, and I were interested in military issues, but we thought we were going to deal with physical injuries. And we started off with service dogs and met these two amazing ladies, Sue Downs and Alexis Cornine, with their beautiful service dogs. And no matter where we started our conversation, it ended up with post-traumatic stress. And then when we started to meet other women veterans, we learned about the other invisible injuries, which are military sexual trauma and sexual assaults, things like that. But we decided that the documentary would be nuanced and a spectrum of experience, not just a single focus. So although we do deal with military sexual trauma, we also show Sue Downs and Alicia Thompson in a well-functioning unit where the men and women completely work together. Mm-hmm. The men have the women's back and the women have the men's back.
So a range of a spectrum. Angela Arellano, I was wondering in watching this film how you and Marsha Rock hooked up. When did you meet?
We actually met at the VA Center in Seattle. My therapist asked me if I wanted to take part in a documentary on women veterans. And that's how I met Marsha. I agreed to do it, and I didn't meet her until the day of.
Tell us a little bit about your military service.
Well, I enlisted when I was 17. I went to boot camp at 17, and I loved it. I got trained to be a mechanic, which was a lot of fun, and went to Okinawa, which is where the MST happened.
And that's military sexual trauma.
Yes. don't really want to go too in-depth on that right now. But aside from that and some of the backlash that happened after that, the rest of my career with the military was great. I had a lot of fun. I enjoyed what I did. Made a lot of good friends that I'm actually still in touch with today.
You served 4 years in the military?
4 years, 7 months active duty.
And so most of it, you say, with the exception of this one event, was great. But this one event, when you were discharged, became more sort of came to the forefront, right?
I would say not until about maybe almost 10 years after I was discharged did it really come out.
But it affected you. I mean, you had trouble, right?
I did, but I guess I didn't realize that I did. I mean, it, looking back, I can say, oh, yes, this is how it did affect me. But at the time, I didn't realize that that's what it was. It wasn't until, like I said, almost 10 years later before I was able to say, wow, this has put a major impact on my life.
Where did you go to seek help?
To the VA. The first time I went was in, I think, when we lived in New York. I went to the VA there. I went to the, was not impressed with the VA system in New York at all. After that, we lived in Florida, and I went to Bay Pines, which was really good. The whole concept of a women's clinic was just forming at the time. So, you know, it was at the beginning stages. But it really wasn't until we moved back to Washington and I got back into the swing of things here. So that in 2005, when I started going to the women's clinic in Seattle, that's where everything really kicked off and put me on the right track to where I am today.
You were seeking weekly counseling at that point, and I know you're not at that point anymore. You've sort of gone beyond that.
Yes.
How long were you in the counseling treatment?
The weekly treatment, oh gosh, I am not even sure how long that went on for. Because, I mean, it was such a bad period that it's hard to say. I mean, it seemed from at the time, it seemed forever. But now looking back, it's like, oh, it wasn't that long. But I was, it was pretty intense, like I said, weekly and doing groups and learning everything I needed to learn to cope and move on.
Angela Arellano, who you're listening to, is a U.S. Marine veteran, served 4 years and 7 months in Okinawa. And she's one of the women profiled in a new documentary film called Service, Women Come Marching Home, and filmmaker Marsha Rock. This, you point out in the film that this VA Women's Center is both, these are new kinds of treatment facilities, and the center in Seattle is taking a very different approach from the traditional way that the military has dealt with women service members.
I would say the Seattle Women's Clinic is a model of treatment for women. And when we were doing the research, women's clinics were just starting. There was a GAO report saying that services for women were too limited in the VA system. Women were in mixed waiting rooms where the men would ogle them, and if they had suffered from military sexual trauma, it would just make it worse. They would go to the front desk and they'd say, "Where's your husband?" So now there's a woman program manager, and she's your advocate, and instead of going through other places, you go to a private room here in Seattle. You have a Jan Buchanan, a fantastic women program manager, and she will help you navigate the system, the paperwork, the doctors. And actually, at our screening last night, I met one of the doctors there, and she was amazing and said the biggest thing that they have to do is to get the women to tell their stories and say that's normal. This is not unusual. What you're going through is what many people go through. Let us help you. Let us take you and put you on a track to get your life back together.
We're talking, Marsha Rock has just made a film which is actually screening this afternoon at 3 o'clock in the Alder Commons Auditorium, which is on the University of Washington campus on Northeast 40th Street in Seattle. And I'm, will all three of you be there?
Yes.
Bridget Cantrell, I apologize, licensed mental health counselor, not a psychologist. How common is it to, at this point, with women vets, to hear stories like Angela's of military sexual trauma or some kind of post-traumatic stress?
Absolutely. It's very common. And what is so wonderful, it's coming out of the woodwork now. And I've been working in this field for over 20 years with veterans. And I am very thrilled to see that there's documentaries like this. There's forums. There's groups. Every time we look in the newspaper, there's an article about how trauma affects men and women, warriors, or military sexual trauma.
And how does it, well, obviously, military sexual trauma might impact more women than men, although I think it does impact men as well. But I'm wondering how women might manifest the signs, the symptoms of post-traumatic stress differently from men.
Well, I was just reading a research article the other night about how the triggers are for women. We're very visual. We will take in visual stimuli and we'll take it to heart right away. And I know I experienced that once. I was in my truck going across the country. I had a special forces soldier in the front seat of my truck and he was ill and we came across a motorcycle crash and I'm driving. The first thing I'm looking at, I go, oh my gosh, that girl has a pair of jeans like I do. I've got a shirt like hers. Look at all the red motorcycle parts all over the place. And his comment was, wow, they must have been going at a pretty good clip. So see, that was an example of how we're drawn into a visual and then we go into an emotional affect situation. So I think that women manifest it differently. We see a lot more of the depression and fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue type symptoms, headaches. There's a lot of more physical issues, whereas with men, we may see more aggressive behaviors, more anger, and there's research on that to show that as well. But nevertheless, it's not a sign of weakness, and it's something that happens to a person that's outside the realm of a normal human experience. So we have different ways of reacting to that, and we're all individuals, so there's no one way to say how we're going to react to those things.
Angela, did you feel like it was just you for a while?
Yeah, I did. 'Cause when you're in it, no one else around me other than my husband had been in the military. My immediate family, they hadn't been in the military, so...
And so you didn't, I mean, you said there were people that you're still connected with from your service days, but it's not like you hung out with a lot of women vets.
No, even though I'm still connected with them, we're all across the country. So I was never in an area where I could be with them. But it was, you feel isolated and alone.
And I think the trauma is amplified by the fact that these are your battle buddies. These are the people you were trained to trust. And it's a huge violation. It's almost like incest.
There's an interesting scene in your film, Marsha Rock, where I'm not sure if these women knew each other before, but there's a woman who is based, I think, in Atlanta who sort of runs a lot of online support groups and is an advocate. And she's sitting in a restaurant or a bar and meets a woman that I believe she only knew online. And it's this sense of connection or maybe a sense of release almost.
Social media has been huge for women veterans. Often they don't want to leave their home, but they will go online. In fact, they all posted photographs and made comments last night after our screening last night. It was like, whoa. So when Brigitte started her group, she attracted people who had never talked about their trauma. And Layla was one of them. So we were very close to where Layla was stationed, actually. And we invited her to come meet us live. And this was the first time Brigitte and Layla met in person. And it was amazing that Layla launched in to her trauma and talked about things she had never even spoken to with her therapist. Now, it's true that a lot of times women vets prefer to talk to other women vets and not professionals. I think Brigitte has some thoughts about that.
I do. You know, for the people that, there's a lot of people that all of a sudden are really interested in working with the military. And I go out to schools and that type of thing and speak to these people. But what I tell them is they need to immerse themselves in the military culture because this is a culture. They have a certain way of speaking, a certain way of dressing, a certain way of reacting to things. And what may be within normal range within the context of the military seems really out there in the civilian world. So for those people that are preparing to work with the military, they really need to educate themselves as much as possible.
Do you work solely with veterans?
No, I don't. I have civilians as well, but my dissertation research was on Vietnam vets, looking at the social support factors in mitigating PTSD. So it's like a calling to me. It's a passion.
Well, so the Vietnam vets, there were some women who served in Vietnam, but not in active combat in the same way that we see in the Middle Eastern wars in particular.
Exactly, but there are a few exceptions. We have a woman that we were talking about that I know that's going to be starting to write her book about her own experience, and she was not a nurse. She was actually in combat situations in Vietnam. So there are exceptions. And nevertheless, it doesn't even matter if you're on the FOB and or wherever. If you're exposed to trauma, you may react to it in a different way than another person. And it can take years for it to manifest.
And the trauma is compounded by the treatment many women and men get when they report it. Layla, you know, they called her a dirty whore. And Angela had a horrible experience when she reported it.
Well, after the investigation was complete, the actual investigators called me a liar. Even in the interview that they did with me, they accused me of lying. And the final investigation came through that nothing happened, that I made it all up. And then after that, I received non-judicial punishment. And I was actually punished for
reporting.
Not for reporting, but for breaking a base rule because I was in this room after hours.
So you got in trouble?
Yes.
And what happened to the person who assaulted you?
He was transferred from our base back to his original base. And that was the extent of his punishment.
So this is in the news now.
Well, I was going to say, Washington Senator Patty Murray with New Hampshire's Kelly Ayotte last week introduced a bill that will increase some measures, particularly providing legal protection and advocacy for the women. One of the things that Senator Murray said to me when I interviewed her about this bill was that this is one thing, but the military culture, changing the culture, is something that you can't legislate. You can't just say, you know, now you have to treat women a certain way. That's something that is much harder to affect.
The impression is that the military doesn't take this seriously. You look at Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkerson, right? He was court-martialed, and his commander overturned that rule and didn't even have to write a report about it. Well, thank goodness the women senators in the Senate Armed Services Committee went crazy. And one of the women in our film testified at that hearing, and everyone was so proud of them that they stood up to the people in the service who were talking about it, and they really took them to task. So maybe the pressure, the public opinion, because it's in the news now, because of documentaries, the conversation is changing.
Were any of the women that you approached to be in your film, Marsha Rock, were they reluctant to tell their stories?
No. They were so happy to have the opportunity. And I do think the camera is a little bit of a truth serum, because there's certain intensity about being on camera that gets you very focused. And once you start, the story starts to flow. I think that happened with you, Angela, right?
Yes, it did.
So you weren't nervous about it?
At first I was. Marsha just has a way, though, of just making you relax. And it's as if the camera's not there and you're just talking to someone you've known your entire life. And it was just a great experience.
Angela told me the entire story, every bit of detail, probably more than she had ever shared with anyone else. In the edit room, of course, I chose what were the important points.
Now, I understand, Angela, that your daughter has enlisted?
Yes, she will be going to basic this summer. She's joined the Army Reserve.
And how do you feel about that?
I am so proud of her. Like I told the reporter from the Seattle Times, it's not my first choice for her in life, but it's her choice. It's her life. It's her decision. And I can only support her in that. I can't protect her any more than her going to college. So if this is what she wants to do, I'm all for it.
Do you have any words of advice for her?
Use the buddy system.
Huh. That's interesting. And as I, when I introduced you three, I mentioned that right now 14% of troops are female, but we're looking at perhaps 28 or 30% within a decade. Will having more women serving just push for attitudinal changes just because of sheer numbers?
I hope so. I think women on their own, when there's one here, one there, can't really do a lot. And I think there's a lot of pressure to be like the guys. But as you see in the Senate, that, you know, having Senator Gillibrand and McCaskill there made a difference. When they became the chair of the committee, the whole conversation changed. And maybe now that women in combat rule has been overturned as well, and women can rise to higher levels easier, faster, I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that will happen. But we don't know. Lieutenant General Susan Helms' promotion is being held up by Senator McCaskill. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know. Is she a single one? It's the same sort of thing that she overturned a sexual military sexual trauma
conviction, right?
Yes.
So I guess in just the last question, I turn to you, Bridget Cantrell, and it has to be, I guess I'm wondering about a word of advice, or if a woman who's listening has experienced either a rape or some other sort of sexual harassment, or is suffering from other kinds of signs of trauma, what should she do?
Well, first of all, I want to say that this is also prevalent in males as well. So anyone that has experienced military sexual trauma or assault or harassment or just trauma in general, please find someone that you can speak to. Share your story, share your burden, and know that it's a transition. And because you've had trauma, that doesn't have to define the rest of your life. And I like the saying, I have PTSD, but it doesn't have me. Why not hang it in a picture on the wall so it doesn't take up the whole room? And I work with this all the time, and it's a process of managing the symptoms and the reactions to things and learning to step outside the box so you can experience life on a different level. But always know that you can come back to your sanctuary, to where you're safe again. But just keep moving forward one baby step at a time and just rejoice those successes and know that there's hope and there's people like myself and other providers. I met incredible providers last night at the forum we had down in Tacoma at the UW, and they're there. They're waiting with open arms to receive you and to honor you and respect your service. So don't give up. Just keep moving forward.
I've been traveling. Patty Stoddard and I have been traveling around the country with the film, and we are so impressed by how much support there is for veterans if they'll only reach out to get it.
Marsha Rock is an independent filmmaker, and her new documentary is called Service, When Women Come Marching Home. Angela Arellano is a veteran of the Marines, and she appears in this film. Bridget Cantrell is a Bellingham-based mental health counselor who specializes in working with people who have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. This film is going to be screening in a public forum at 3 this afternoon on the University of Washington campus in the Alder Commons Auditorium, which is on Northeast 40th Street.
And it's going to be on KCTS on May 26th at 11 p.m.
Thanks, all three of you, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
This is KUOW.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Organic gardening advice in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Avalon Northwest Landscape, offering custom landscape design and construction to expand a home's living space into the outdoors. Committed to quality, client satisfaction, and environmental stewardship on every project. Portfolio online at avalonnw.com.
53 degrees in Seattle. We've got clouds, but they are thinning out. It's going to turn partly sunny today with a predicted high of 65.
Evening tours of KUOW's broadcast facility are now available to listeners ages 15 and older. This month's evening tour is Thursday, May 16th at 6:15 p.m. Space is limited. To schedule a tour, call 206-543-2710 or email tours at kuow.org.
10:39. I'm Bernard Willett. The National Transportation Safety Board wants states to drop the blood alcohol threshold for drunk driving to 0.05. It's currently 0.08 here in Washington. More about this new recommendation in 20 minutes.
It is Tuesday, and that means we're going to talk about gardening with a regular panel of gardeners. Marty Winkett writes about garden and travel at her website, martywinkett.com. Her most recent book is Landscaping for Privacy. Greg Rayburn's the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter's been a practicing horticulturalist for more than 30 years. She is the Garden Hotline Program Coordinator at Seattle Tilth. Thanks for coming in. And our phone number, 1-800-289-5869. But I think we need somebody to release the phone lines because right now they're all tied up. So somebody in the other room needs to do that. 543-5869 is our phone number. I just have to ask, Laura, because I love that they call you a practicing horticulturalist. Is there somebody who's like a non-practicing horticulturalist?
Theoretical horticulturalist?
Yeah, I mean, what does that mean?
That's a really good point. I think that it goes to the fact that people on the hotline are still in the trade in some fashion.
Oh, okay.
So that we're not just, people that have gotten a degree and are sitting behind a desk. So I think that's the point of that.
Okay. So she knows what she's talking about. We've got a lot of emails, and you can email us weekday at kuow.org. And I promise that we'll release the phone line soon at 206-543-5869. Rico says, good morning to all. I got about 25 foxglove off Craigslist last year, and I planted them in with all of my natives. They flowered and looked great, but not one came back this year. They were under some Doug firs, but they did get afternoon sun. Anything I can do to keep them around in the future?
I've never known.
No, they usually come back. They might be somewhere else.
Yeah, they usually reseed bountifully. Yeah. And
well, they've never left my garden. They were there when we moved in, and varying numbers of them from year to year, depending on how judiciously I weed them out. So they are biennials, which means as long as you didn't cut off the flower stems, which had turned to seed, if you let it go to seed, then this year you will get plants and next year you will get flowers. And pretty soon, after a few years, there are some coming and flowering every year, but they are biennials.
Huh. So should Rico just sit tight or
look around, see if you see any little rosettes of leaves out there?
Is this
unless you weeded them out?
When don't they bloom a little bit later?
They are getting ready to bloom.
Wow. Is that because we've had such warm weather?
No.
This is a normal time.
Late May, yeah, into June, I guess.
I always thought of foxglove as, I hate to say weeds, but, semi-invasive.
They have naturalized along the roadsides.
Yeah, they're very, very common, but they aren't a native plant.
They are not a native
plant.
They're
not a native plant. They're probably the most common plant I hear people say that they consider a native just because there's, they'll see them up in clear cuts and areas like that but they can just readily be reintroduced to areas and really take off.
I think they're pretty, but I guess I'm not sure I would plant them intentionally.
Most our invasive plants are pretty.
And yes, I was watching a story about, that yellow scotch broom that's everywhere. Maybe more invasive than a foxglove. Nibris says, this is, I guess, a question for you, Marty. I want to make a 6 to 8 foot high partition of a shrub between my home and my neighbor's home. What can you recommend, which is cheapest? Someone told me English laurel. Please advise.
Oh, dear. Well, if you have a really wide space between you and your neighbors, or if you love to get out there and shear a hedge twice a year,
laurel then is the plant
for you. Laurel.
Okay.
It is evergreen, so that's, I would suggest, I don't know how cheap these are, but it is fast growing. And although it does not provide a solid screen, it does help. a plant called Azara. I'm sorry, I don't know a common name for it. A-Z-A-R-A. Most nurseries carry it now, Azara microphylla. It has little green leaves, but it's evergreen, and it will take some shade. And that's often what we, but I have shade there. Well, you know, then you've eliminated a whole bunch of plants.
And it will get 6 to 8 feet high?
Oh, my gosh. It will get 12 to 15 feet high. But it is quite accommodating to, you can take branches down and keep it shorter if you
And it needs less maintenance than laurel?
Yes. Laurel wants to be 30 feet wide and 30 feet high. That is what it is.
Wow.
And another note of caution with laurel is it's incredibly difficult to get rid of once it's established because, you know, people try and cut it off and then it'll just regrow from roots. And
so it's like a morning glory?
Yeah, it is. It's really tough.
A woody morning glory.
And it has fruits which get spread to our natural areas. So it really is a problem plant.
So don't plant English laurel, I think, is the message that you two are so politely...
Subtly.
Yeah, dodging around. 1-800-289-5869 is our phone number. Our gardeners are here as they are every Tuesday in the 10 o'clock hour. Hi, Bunny. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm having... my son's getting married in my backyard in August, and I wondered if there's any flowering things I could plant now that would bloom then.
Well, there are things that will bloom in August, but if they're perennials, your choice is either to buy them small now and they won't be blooming very much in August, if at all, or wait until all the nurseries have sales in July, often on perennials, and buy big containers of already flowering plants. And then you will have flowers in the garden. And annuals, too. I mean, you can really go to town on the sales that nurseries have midsummer. And you can get a lot of color. Planting now for color, you could get a lot of geraniums, summer geraniums, and put pots of those around. Those would look gorgeous.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, good
luck with that wedding. We are talking gardening, and does it matter for annuals if it's sunny? Do they care?
Most annuals that we love to plant are sun-loving plants.
Aren't they tropical in origin?
I guess if you go back
to their ancestry.
Summer geraniums are from South Africa, I think. Pelargonium, that's the genus name. And they're gorgeous. I love huge pots of scarlet and salmon colored and they're wonderful. Lots of perhaps not petunias, but those small flowers that look like baby miniature petunias. They're called Calibrachoa. You can get million bells, and there are a bunch of different commercial names for them. And they're mostly trailers out of pots. They look wonderful and they provide great color. California fuchsia, I have Zauschneria.
What a name.
I love saying that. I have a large pot of that beside the back porch, which is threatening to take over the world. I cut it back every winter and it comes back and the hummingbirds love it. And it blooms in orange, kind of red orange, tubular flowers. With gray-green leaves in the background. That's wonderful.
I was just thinking how pretty a little wedding arbor with scarlet runner beans might be in August.
Oh, plant now.
They might not be blooming by then. You'd probably have the beans, unfortunately.
Yeah. And everybody could have that for the instead of an hors d'oeuvre.
Pick your own salad. We'll blanch the beans. And
well, you know, that's an interesting point. Our email is weekday@kuow.org. And Vicki in Tacoma, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a deep purple iris that I bought at the last Point Defiance flower show. And I put it in a pot. And now it's like the center of it is nothing growing. It's growing around the edges. And some years I get blooms and some I don't. Do I need to repot it? And how do I do that? And does it need fertilizer?
Is it a bearded iris? Are the leaves upright and sword-like, flat?
They are upright, but they're more narrow than a general iris leaf. They're about as wide as my finger.
And would it be blooming now if it was in bloom?
It's got 6 or 7 blossoms ready to pop.
And
last year, nothing.
So there are... Bearded iris blooming now, and there are Siberian iris blooming now. Siberian iris are a little bit more delicate looking, and the foliage is a little bit greener and grassier looking. Is that a good? Do you think that that's what it is?
They couldn't tell me what it was when I bought it. They just said it was good for a northern climate.
I think you should take a picture of that iris and send it to the hotline, the Seattle Tilth Hotline, and let them ID it for you, and then they can give you some good care technique. Iris in pots are a little difficult.
It sounds like it might be a Siberian iris. That would be my guess. And they can kind of fade out in the middle like that.
Mine has.
And yes, sometimes repotting can help that, or you can break it into smaller clumps and make more plants out of it.
So how would she send a picture to you?
You can email us at help@gardenhotline.org and just attach a photo to that.
Okay. Good luck.
Okay.
Good luck with that, Vicki. Thanks for your call. I have noticed bearded iris this week everywhere I go. So this is their season.
Yeah.
And you mentioned they're not often in pots, iris. They're happier if they're in the ground?
I think that I would have trouble. I'm sure I would have trouble with bearded iris in a pot. They want to be planted near the surface, and they want to be in baking sun. And I suppose you could do it in pots, and then if you could move the pots elsewhere after they bloom, because, you know, it's one thing to see some of those sword-like leaves coming up in a certain area in the garden, but if it's a pot and...
Well, my question about iris has to do with usually what happens is that they get that mat, that large, large mat, and then they stop blooming because there's too much of a mat. So if that's my issue, is this the time to break it up? And no, Laura says, no.
No. Now's when they're blooming, but even if they're not blooming, this is sort of a top growth time for them. So it's better to wait until they've kind of... you know, faded back down, or you could do that in the fall as well.
September's a good time.
And so I would dig up that mat and just break it apart?
Yep.
Okay, I'll ask you that again in 3 or 4 months. Our phone number 206-543-KUOW or 1-800-289-KUOW. Hi, Tyler in Gig Harbor. You're on the air. Tyler?
Hello?
Hi.
Yes?
Go ahead.
Well, I have a question. When the spring planting season comes around and plants are starting to vegetate and everything, my biggest problem that I'm running into are bugs, specifically spider mites. And I was wondering, is there any organic deterrent to these bugs that just completely wipe out my crops? Or are these the traditional ladybug approach the best way to go about fixing the problem? I just thought the panel might be able to help, and if it does help, the plants are marijuana plants.
Spider mites are typically there when plants are stressed or under kind of harsh conditions. Excuse me. And so you can improve those conditions, you'll have less trouble with the spider mites. We don't see a lot of them, you know, in outdoor gardens in Washington, not too often, but you do get them usually when things get drier. And so humidity can deter them. They like dust and dry and those kind of conditions. I would suggest changing your conditions as much as possible.
Changing the conditions? Okay.
All right. Thanks, Tyler. From our Facebook page, Teresa wants you to repeat, Marty, the shrub. Was it Azara?
Azara. Azara microphylla just means it has small
little leaves.
Yeah.
Azara microphylla.
And they are fairly fast growing. I mean, they'll put on, once you get them in the ground, they'll put on up to a foot some years once established.
That's pretty fast growing.
Yeah.
Linda emails from Bainbridge Island. What happened? My lilac bush only got 2 flowers this year while the wisteria and yellow magnolia went wild with color and bloom.
Well, was the lilac pruned?
I don't know, Linda. Was the lilac pruned?
So that's if you prune too late in the year, you may be... flowering shrubs usually set their flowers for the following year pretty soon after they flower. And so if you wait until winter to prune, you may be pruning out flowering stems first. Second of all, is it near a lawn that got a lot of nitrogen fertilizer? Nitrogen promotes leafy growth, but not necessarily flowers. So those are two things.
Could be any reason then, Linda.
Yeah.
So is the advice then that you never prune a lilac?
Oh, no. I have seen there's a huge round lilac that a couple of blocks from us. And every once in a while in a year, they will cut it back really hard. And so then they don't get very many flowers the next year. But the following year, they get tons of flowers again.
We go now to Ferndale, where Lucy's on the line. Hi, Lucy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question about my blueberry bushes. They're well-established bushes. And last year, one or two of them started, the leaves started turning sort of yellowish during the summer. They didn't fruit well. This year, probably four out of the six seem to be dying. And I'm sort of frantic about what to do about them because I love the blueberries so much. So any suggestions you could make? I usually add maybe once every year, every other year, some chicken manure or some other acidic mulch. But I'm just don't know what to do.
How old are these plants?
How old? Probably 10 years.
Age could have some effect on them. That could be part of it. It could also be, you know, when you're adding mulch to something, the first thing I check is the base of a plant, especially a woody shrub, to see if I've been adding too much mulch or if they've settled. Because if you get too much organic matter up around the trunk of the plant, you can actually start to kill it that way.
And I've tried to be careful about that, uh-huh. because I know that, yeah.
So check that closely. That would be my first suggestion. And then from there, you know, check how much water they're getting. They do like to stay pretty moist in the summertime. And so stressing them without enough water can cause that as well.
So do you think at this point, I mean, some of the branches are actually dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaves are not turning into a nice bright green.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there could be some decline there. You might have to do some replacement. And maybe, you know, you might want to check soil conditions before you do that. Make sure everything's okay there.
Was your chicken manure well composted?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Because okay. You thought it might have burnt.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you have a little more detective work to do, Lucy, and maybe at least try replacing some of those plants. Mm-hmm. Good luck with that. It is really sad when your plant leaves. Dean has a question I have. Anything to do that I can do to get rid of tent caterpillars other than cut the nests out and burn them? I'm afraid to prune my fruit trees more than I have. And the tent caterpillars are going nuts right now. This is true.
Yes, but they haven't built up to their peak, have they? That's going to be in another year or two, probably.
Oh,
yeah. Well, it seems like it's been a few years. They seem to go in pretty good.
It's like plagues of locusts.
Oh, my gosh. I remember my sister-in-law in Bainbridge said she was afraid to put her hand on the railing of the deck outside. It was like tent caterpillar freeway.
Yeah.
So is there anything to do besides, you know, cutting them out and burning them?
If you're that concerned, birds do a nice job of working on them. And we also have a parasitic wasp. One thing I really like doing is going out and looking at the some of the tent caterpillars, and you'll see this little spot on their head, and you know that they're basically the walking dead.
Zombie caterpillars.
They have the little hatch.
So this is, you're saying that what we're seeing now, Marty, is a prelude to a worse infestation?
Well, it has, there have been worse years, don't you think, Greg?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. Right outside my window at my desk, in one of the, I don't know if they're pin oaks or what they have planted on the Ave here, you can just see these clumps of swarming tent caterpillars. So the non-organic way is a wasp or fire. That's it?
Well, you don't have to. It's not like you have to burn them if you cut them out of the tree. I mean, they're not.
You can stomp on them instead.
You can put them in. They're not something. I know that, bringing out the weed burner, you really feel like you're getting revenge on these couple-inch long
Okay, with that violence, we end our gardening session. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward and ruthless host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter, a practicing horticulturalist, she knows what she's talking about when you contact the Garden Hotline program at Seattle Tilth. She's the coordinator. Thanks for coming in. And Marty Wingett writes about gardens and travel at MartyWingett.com, and I think is winging off on her own on a travel.
Indeed.
Have a great trip.
Thank you.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Alsadi. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us tomorrow here on 94.9 KUOW.
There are toxic chemicals in some children's products, and here in Washington State, companies are required to disclose the presence of only some of those toxic chemicals, not all of them. We'll learn more about that today during the noon hour. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral programs in six different colleges. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
The state Supreme Court today took up the case of payment cuts to in-home caregivers. We'll have more on that in the news in a moment.
KUOW and Jack Straw Productions present an evening of new work, read by residents in the 2013 Jack Straw Writers Program and hosted by curator Stephanie Kalis, Friday, May 17th at 7 p.m. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
54 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 60. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.